The American Society of Newspaper Editors, some 500 editors and publishers from across the nation, today open their annual convention here in Washington. ABC Radio now brings you recorded highlights of the inaugural address, delivered to delegates by Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg opened his speech saying how he's enjoying the change from being Secretary of Labor to a Supreme Court Justice. He began with a quotation.
During the few months immediately after his appointment, he found the studious and meditative life of the judge so great a contrast to the exciting labors of a cabinet minister that a man of his executive drive could not but feel a temporary irksomeness as from the loss of customary muscular exercise. His shoulders at first did not feel weight enough in his gown, but he soon brought his faculties into such harmony with his office that he now takes up each new case with a freshness of spirit that shows how a total change in one's intellectual habits in mature years may prove one of the best methods of keeping an elderly gentleman from growing old. Ladies and gentlemen, that statement, which I confirm, was contained in a letter written by a friend of Salmon Portland Chase, Secretary of Treasury under Abraham Lincoln, to another friend on the occasion of 3 months after the appointment of Chief Justice Chase to the Supreme Court on December 6, 1864. A constitution which commands freedom for the press should inspire responsibility by the press. The framers of our Constitution and Bill of Rights contemplated both a free and a responsible press. They vested in the courts the duty of assuring the constitutional freedom of expression, and in the press itself, the prime responsibility for making sure that its freedom is employed in the service and not in the destruction of our liberties. Every editor, I am sure, has found occasion to recall Thomas Jefferson's classic statement, "The basis of our government being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep the right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate to prefer the latter." Fortunately, in our free land, we are not compelled to make this choice. And I would paraphrase Jefferson to say this: we cannot have a free government without a free press, and we cannot have a free press without a free government. Both ancient and modern history teach that the first step of a regime moving toward autocracy is restraint and control of speech and press. And this is invariably the beginning of the destruction of all other liberties. It is the American constitutional conviction that freedom of speech and of the press is at the core of liberty. Justice Cardozo, in his felicitous way and style, observed that, and I quote him, "Freedom of expression is the matrix, the indispensable condition of nearly every other form of freedom." Implicit in this statement is the recognition of the simple fact that where men cannot freely convey their thoughts to one another, no other liberty is secure. where freedom of expression exists, the germ of a free society is already present and a means at hand for every extension of liberty. The first and primary responsibility of the press, in my opinion, is therefore as protector and promoter of all the rights and liberties of Americans. The entire Bill of Rights is in the press's charge, not only the free speech clause of the First Amendment. A newspaper which fails to exercise its right of free expression in protest against the invasion by any branch of government, the executive, the legislative, or the judicial, of freedom of thought, of conscience, of assembly, and of the person, defaults in its most elementary duty and responsibility. But the press must not only be the protector of all the amendments against their invasion by government, it must also be the protector against their infringement by the press itself. Our Bill of Rights assures the press freedom to report and comment, yet at the same time it guarantees to all a certain modicum of privacy. It requires that all trials be public and that the press have access to them. Yet at the same time it guarantees to those accused of crime a trial by an impartial jury and with due process of law. It is often urged, and I believe you had some discussion about this morning, that these rights are incompatible, that there can be no right of privacy unless the freedom of press is curtailed, that there can be no impartial jury or due process of law unless the press is under the control of the courts. I, for one, cannot agree that these rights are incompatible or divisible, that one must be sacrificed if the other is to survive. Under the principles of the Bill of Rights, the prime responsibility, as I have said, for assuring that the press does not unduly invade the rights of privacy and fair trial rests not with the government, as it does in many parts of the world, England is an example, but with the press itself. The press, therefore, must measure up to this responsibility. The press has a particularly acute responsibility in the area of crime reporting, especially in the pretrial phase. Of course, here as elsewhere, the press must report the news. Suppression of this news, crime news, like suppression of any other news, is not to be tolerated. The rights of the accused person, however, must also be respected. The public, from whom jurors will be selected, must be informed, but not prejudiced. It must be informed about crime news, as indeed it must be informed about all public matters, so that it can prevent abuses both by government and by criminal elements in our society. All too often, however, we must resort to jurors who are not informed in order to be certain that we are getting jurors who are not prejudiced by what they have read in the newspapers. It is sad that in this highly literate and educated country, the only acceptable jurors are frequently those who have taken an oath that they have read no newspapers or magazines for the past year. It is regrettable that experienced defense attorneys on occasions are compelled to say, and judges are compelled to rule, that a juror who has read newspaper accounts of the crime and arrest is bound to have prejudged the case against the defendant. Some of the fault, in my opinion, lies simply in the labels chosen by the press to describe the accused of crime. Weeks before, and even on the eve of trial, the accused is all too often referred to as the killer, the robber, or the hoodlum. All the good that courts can do in reiterating our constitutional presumption of innocence can be easily erased by the press's constant reference to the accused as the criminal. Take, for example, the case of the 15-year-old New York boy named Peter, to whom our friend Edward R. Murrow devoted a program some years ago. Peter, if you remember the program, had been charged with the brutal murder of an elderly man in Central Park. Newspaper headlines referred to the boy as a young hoodlum and a vicious killer. Little mention was made of the boy's clean record, of his unequivocal denial of the charge, or of the apparent paucity of evidence and witnesses against him. As it turned out, at the trial, the only evidence against the boy was the testimony of a 13-year-old girl with whom he had been spent part of the time on the night of the killing. In court, the girl admitted that her testimony was given because of her ambition to be a star witness in a big trial. In court, it was also revealed that the dying man had made a statement identifying his assailants as two big boys. Peter was acquitted. He was fortunate where others have not been. But even so, the damage to his name and to that of his family is immeasurable and doubly tragic because irresponsible press comment compounded his difficulties. The remedy in cases like this is not to curtail the press's freedom. It is to encourage responsibility. Some of the fault lies in lack of knowledge and a failure of communication between the bar and the press. The bar, when it is critical of the press, must remember that all too few newspaper men have had legal training and that what may be elementary to the lawyer who is accustomed to use the word alleged criminal, is fraught with jargon and complexity for the layman. The bar must be willing to inform the press, and the press must be willing to listen. My own law school, Northwestern University Law School, has for the past few years conducted an annual course in criminal news analysis and reporting, which brings together members of the press and the bar in an effort to educate for professional responsibility and self-restraint. Programs such as this hold much promise. It also seems to me that it would be most helpful in this area if this organization of editors were to revive and refurbish its existing code of ethics by adding specific standards of crime reporting, which, while preserving complete freedom for the press, will also adequately safeguard the rights of an accused. The bar, I hope, will be, but in any event should be, glad to cooperate in a joint effort, perhaps through a joint committee, to articulate these standards. Freedom of the press is not an end in itself. It is a means of guaranteeing that ideas deserving a public hearing will have a public hearing. The press, which has the constitutional freedom to print the news, therefore has the correlative moral obligation, and I speak in moral terms here, not in constitutional terms, to supply the public need for accurate and comprehensive news coverage. Today, in a nuclear age, every citizen is importantly involved in public policy, and newspapers must supply the public need for the source materials which are necessary to fashion policy. Increasingly in this country, we are of one mind with Pericles when he said in the memorable funeral oration to the Athenians, "We alone regard a man who takes no interest in public affairs, not as a harmless, but as a useless character. If we are not to be a nation of useless characters, the press must supply us with the facts, the news not only of national, but of international affairs. In a complex world, our future as a nation depends upon a mentally alert society, a citizenry with experience, thought, and feeling about their own and other lands and peoples beyond the range of private observation. It is a responsibility of an uncensored press to assist in keeping the people mentally alert. My colleague, Justice Douglas, who has traveled widely through the world, has accurately described the state of men denied access to a free press. This is what he said. Those who doubt the thesis that man needs full freedom of expression to realize his own capacities and become a cultured citizen of the world need only visit the totalitarian states and see how man has shriveled under the impact of censorship, how poorly he has fared under the diet of one creed. The horizons of the citizen in the conformity state are so limited, he cannot react intelligently to the world around him. It is our great strength as a nation that in our nonconformity, the horizons of our citizens are as wide as our free education and our free press will extend them. News coverage should be extensive. It should also be truthful. The Constitution precludes the imposition of liability on a newspaper for false statements in the public area that are not malicious. This constitutional standard is not fashioned to encourage or excuse deviations from accuracy, but so that the First Amendment freedoms essential for an enlightened citizenry will not be chilled by harsh statements, harsh penalties for mere misstatements. A newspaper man's creed, however, must always be that stated by that great journalist, my fellow townsman, Melville E. Stone, upon the founding of the Chicago Daily News. And this is what Mr. Stone had to say. I had a view that the relation of a newspaper to a community was not very different from that of an individual. And so, in our dispensing the news, we are not unlike the witness in court, bound to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. E.W. Scripps, co-founder of the Scripps Howard newspaper, said the same thing in different words. We shall tell no lies about persons or policies for love, malice, or money. If reporting the news objectively, truthfully, and adequately is the first function and responsibility of a newspaper, then stating its opinion about the news is a close second. Rice in the American Commonwealth said that newspapers are influential in three ways: as narrators, as advocates, and as weathercocks. A newspaper which is only a narrator and not an advocate misconceives its responsibility to the public. The public need cannot be served by reporting the news alone. It requires vigorous and informed comment. The editorial pages of every newspaper should be the proud badge of a great profession. Ideally, it should reflect a variety of vigorous opinion. I emphasize variety as well as vigor because in many one newspaper towns, the publisher and editor have the plain responsibility of providing columns and other materials presenting views which do not merely echo the editorials. The newspaper in the one newspaper town must on its editorial pages serve the role of several newspapers with different opinions. The one thing, however, which is excluded for any newspaper worthy of the name is editorial neutrality. Here again I quote Melville Stone. The paper, while independent in all things, must be neutral to none. The very classless nature of American society imposes a particular responsibility upon the press. Social conflicts in our country are of a sophisticated kind and not as overt as in other less fortunate lands. The press, however, would do a great disservice to ignore our conflicts or to fail to place them in proper perspective. The Commission on Freedom of the Press in its 1947 report astutely stated the problem. Free expression is destined not to repress social conflict, but to liberate it. But its intention is that the level of social conflict shall be lifted from the plane of violence to the plane of discussion. And I would say that a responsible press should not and cannot be a cowardly press. The press must be an example for all citizens that we have staked our all as a nation on the proposition that there is no cure for bad arguments, either in refusing to argue or repression of the free critic in the patient attempt to reach the elements of reasonableness in the common mind. A century and a half ago, that perceptive visitor to our shores, Alexis de Tocqueville, anticipated one of America's present dilemmas. And this is what he said. The more equal the conditions of men become, and the less strong men individually are, the more easily they give way to the current of the multitude, and the more difficult it is for them to adhere by themselves to an opinion which the multitude discard. A newspaper represents an association. It may be said to address each of its readers in the name of all the others and to exert its influence over them in proportion to their individual weaknesses. The power of the newspaper press must therefore increase as the social conditions of men become more equal. This is what de Tocqueville said. Ladies and gentlemen, the social conditions of men in America, very happily, have become more equal since de Tocqueville wrote these words. The power of the press has increased as he predicted, and so have its responsibilities. Our Constitution has made the press free. You have it in your charge to make it responsible. It is for you to demonstrate that press freedom and responsibility are viable and indivisible concepts. Thank you very much.
ABC Radio has brought you recorded highlights of the inaugural address today at the annual convention of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Some 500 of the nation's top editors and publishers gathered here to discuss the major problems facing newspapers across the country. The address delivered by Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. The convention continues through tomorrow and Saturday. Future speakers will include Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Sergeant Shriver, Director of the Peace Corps and the Administration's War on Poverty. This is John Casserly, ABC, Washington.